This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Deputy Mayor and Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henlees, Jeff Gollop. Joining us on the line too is Brexit Party MEP for South West England and Widdicombe. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. Notable by their absence on this show in the run-up to Brexit, I'm afraid, this year, have been all Bristol's MPs, four Labour and two Conservative, as well as Labour Mayor Marvin Rees and the Metro Mayor Tim Bowles. Despite their refusals to come on and talk about Brexit, which is what we're all talking about, I'll keep asking them. Let's hope they pluck up courage to answer some questions before Halloween. After the 7 o'clock news, the US is blocking help for refugees and medical supplies to Iran. A special report, believe it or not, from the BBC. And Indian administrative Jammu Kashmir and its 8 million mainly Muslim population are put on curfew through its 6,000 square miles. All telephones and internet have been cut off. Why? The state's limited autonomy has been ended, much like Northern Ireland or Catalonia. 500,000 Indian soldiers are now occupying the province. That's one for every 15 Kashmiris, turning the state, which went to India in 1947 via Mountbatten with fake promises of a referendum, into a powder keg. Some say Mountie deliberately left Muslim Kashmir to Hindu India as a time bomb for the future. So tonight, Kashmir is a vast prison camp, three times the size of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and with double the population. And like the Rohingyas down the road, why is it always the Muslims that get it in the neck? Modi's move is a provocation to China's interest in the region too. And Pakistan and India are both nuclear-armed states. Also tonight, we take a look at alternative therapy specialists. Alternative treatments for Alzheimer's and cancer, both up against the pharmaceutical industry, health campaigners say he's only interested in shareholders' profit. And the UK regulators, NICE and MHRA, have they been captured by Big Pharma with Glaxo and Merck's pliable people on the boards? That's all in the second hour after the news, or we hope to have some sort of news at 7 o'clock. First, though, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius, wet and windy. This weekend, highs of 20, strong winds and light rain, showers tomorrow. Not really bad enough to put a festival off, I would have thought. But anyway, light cloud on Sunday. Next week, highs are again around 20, warm, some sunny spells and showers, occasionally heavy. Next weekend, that's the 17th and 18th of August, highs of 20, sunshine and heavy showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, you might have gathered, we're not in our new normal studio this week because we're actually down the road at Stokes Croft at the PRSC studio and broadcasting live on PRSC radio stream, because there is no live studio at BCFM at the moment, having been hit by a fire late yesterday morning. And BCFM hopes to have live programmes going out from around about Sunday, Monday, as the technical people will be working very hard over the weekend to get BCFM back on FM live. But so anyway, we're doing our best in the meantime. So joining me to review this week's news is Deputy Mayor and Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henlees, Jeff Gollop. Hi, Jeff, and welcome to the Politics
Hello,
Show.
Hello, Tony. But just to make clear, it's former Deputy Mayor.
Oh, well, you're not Deputy Mayor anymore, no? Just take us through that? What happened?
No. So I was deputy to the previous Mayor, George Ferguson, when he lost. I went back to the back benches, and I'm now the chair of the council main scrutiny committee, but not responsible.
In a way, doing scrutiny, I guess you're kind of an important figure in the opposition in the city now, though, aren't you?
It's an interesting role, and it provides a lot of chance to check what the administration are getting up to, and there are a lot of interesting topics that we could discuss.
There certainly are. I mean, we'll be talking about those in a minute, but I'm also joined on the line by Brexit Party MEP for South West England, Anne Widdicombe. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about your journey from Conservative MP to Brexit Party MEP?
Yes, indeed I can. I was one of those who voted in the 1975 referendum, but I subsequently became a member of parliament. I became a minister. And through my 7 years as a minister, I gradually became convinced that we simply had no power at all, that anything that Europe said we had to do, we had to do. And that if we wanted to do something that they didn't want us to do, we weren't able to do it. And so gradually I did become very disillusioned by Europe.
Sorry to interrupt you, but can you talk about some specifics? I mean, 7 years as a minister is a long time, and it's quite okay. You're allowed to say that we couldn't do what we wanted to do as a minister, but I want to hear specifically at least one or two things that you wanted to do but you couldn't do.
Yes, you can. And what's more, there's a very, very recent one which had nothing to do with me at all, but where the then coalition were trying to make it smoother in raising state pension age for women, and they wanted to keep the distinction between women and men for another couple of years so that they could phase it in more gently, and Europe told them they couldn't. As for me, when I was there, I was in the pensions department. On one occasion, we actually had to put in an opt-out on something to the Maastricht Treaty, because otherwise our pension system would have been broken. There were numerous lesser examples of where we wanted things phased in and the EU wanted them done quickly. It was particularly bad in social security and in employment. It was much less bad in the Home Office. But in those first two offices, I seem to spend all my time in Europe. But if I could just go on with what I was saying.
Yeah, of course.
When the referendum then took place in 2016, I was delighted. I thought, right, that's it. Parliament passed by a large majority, Article 50. I thought, fine, we're going. I, like many people, have become increasingly frustrated over the last 3 years with the absolute lack of progress. And I think Parliament has turned the country into something of a laughingstock. So that disillusionment and that frustration eventually culminated in something I never thought I'd do. I was 55 years a member of the Conservative Party, and I left, and I joined the Brexit Party because I want to see firm action and an end to all the uncertainty.
I mean, you're saying that Europe was very annoying over social security and it made it impossible for us to do what we want. But actually, the record in the EU for providing welfare payments, for example, is nothing like as bad as it is here. Universal credit has been roundly condemned from almost all parties now in Britain. And so surely what you were up against there was a European Union that was actually trying to make things easier and better for people who were having to claim benefits.
No, that is not so. I understand why you think that might have been, but in fact, if you look at some of our benefits and some benefits within the EU, you find ours are much better. So it isn't just a case of, oh, we didn't want to do this and the EU insisted that we did. For example, when they were bringing in paternity leave, we said, right, we want to take it much more gently for small employers. And they were very, very rigid. I mean, I know. I used to sit on the other side of negotiating tables with them. So I had thought that when it enlarged, and this I really did think, and it took in the Eastern Bloc, and it took in Romania and Bulgaria, and I was a minister at the time, I thought this is good news because they simply can't afford the amount of regulation that the EU imposes. But I was wrong. It wasn't good news at all.
How has it been for you then, being an MEP elected, to really just get Britain out of the EU? What's the atmosphere been like, and have you been able to actually do anything useful in the European Parliament?
Well, most of my useful stuff, quite honestly, is casework. It's helping people, people who aren't getting their, farmers, for example, who aren't getting their European payments, fishermen who are very badly hit by a recent EU directive. Somebody who's trying to get a pension from Belgium, which for some odd reason has been stopped. Those sorts of casework things I can do, enjoy doing, and get a huge amount of satisfaction from. But you're quite right. When it comes to actually the work that we do in the European Parliament, now some of it we can get engaged in, but a lot of it refers to a time when we are supposed to have left. I don't know whether we will have left or not. And therefore, it's very difficult for us to take those sorts of decisions.
Jeff, As a Conservative here in Bristol, how do you view what's been happening with the referendum? Anne says she's pretty disillusioned that we haven't left yet. I mean, we heard many times, didn't we, from Theresa May, that we were most definitely going to leave. There's going to be no delays or anything like that. And, of course, we're still here, still waiting.
Well, first of all, let me make clear, I'm expressing my views, not any party political views. My personal view is that I'm sad that we're leaving, but my political recognition is that the majority of people in this country voted to leave, and the government was responsible for delivering that pledge. And the position we're in now is that we have a Prime Minister who is committed to delivering that pledge. So,
actually, Theresa May said she was too.
Theresa May was trying to negotiate and broker a deal. I think it's proven very clearly that you can't even please half the people or half the views in the country at any one time, and certainly not enough to get a majority vote through even the House of Commons, let alone through a referendum. We now have a different style of leadership, and that is probably necessary in order to deliver what the British people.
Okay, I'm going to ask you all three of you, Martin, you too. It's the first question I'll ask you, Martin, but are we going to leave on Halloween or not?
I think not, because the numbers just don't stack up. Well, I think there's plenty of...
This is in Parliament you're talking about?
The numbers in Parliament, and also if you look at opinion polls, it's not actually clear that there's a majority for a no-deal Brexit. It's just not there.
Well, this is an opinion poll. That was a referendum. The opinion poll said we weren't going to vote for Brexit before.
Well, okay,
but let's just look at the... Can Parliament actually stop it? This is what we're hearing. What we've been hearing this week is that Parliament can't stop it.
Well, there are various opinions about what's going to happen next. We're actually looking at the fine print of the...
So what's your opinion?
My opinion is that we're not going to leave on the 31st, because there are legal problems with it if you haven't got a majority in Parliament. And I'm not a lawyer, but lots of lawyers are looking at all of this.
Okay, Jeff?
For me, a no-deal Brexit would be an economic disaster. So, therefore, I hope that we leave when we have negotiated the final deal.
But that may be next year, it might even be 2021.
It might be. I believe it will be sooner than that, but simply leaving on a randomly chosen date when we don't have all the trading arrangements in place to make it happen is madness for the country, it's the madness for everybody, and I think a majority of people recognise that.
Anne?
I'm terribly sorry. I can hardly hear what the others are saying. In fact, I got very little of that last one. But I think what you're asking me is, are we going at Halloween?
Yes.
I wouldn't put money on it, quite honestly. I think Boris does have the will. I give him that. I think he's got the will. But he's facing exactly the same parliamentary arithmetic that Theresa May was facing. His opponents are very, very determined to stop, certainly, a no-deal Brexit. I wouldn't like to say which way I think things are going to go. And, of course, all the talk at the moment is of a general election.
Do you think that will happen before we leave the European Union, Anne?
I think it is very likely that we will have an election this autumn. Now, whether it is timed for us to leave after the 31st, so that we actually disappear in the middle of a campaign, or whether before or after, I wouldn't like to say. But I would really expect an election this autumn.
Well, who is the no-deal Brexit minister? Does anyone know? It's Michael Gove.
It's Michael Gove,
you were going to say, but that's after I said it, Martin. Anyway, so we're going to have a listen now to what Michael Gove had to say about... He believes it's all going to be very simple, very easy, and it'll all happen before Halloween, or on Halloween, as scheduled. So let's have a listen to what Michael Gove had to say earlier this week. Speaking to a BBC reporter who, by the way, I did listen carefully, but they never actually credited her, so I can't credit her either. And she was reporting earlier this week down in Dover.
I think if we do leave without a deal on October the 31st, there will inevitably be bumps in the road. But it's my job to make sure that we're as ready as possible for all contingencies. And one of the reasons why I'm here in Dover today is that I've been talking to the people who manage this port. I've been talking to the people who are responsible for freight that travels to... to Europe, and I've been talking to those who manage other ports in order to make sure that goods can flow, that people can receive in their supermarkets and shops everything that they need, and Britain's industry and commerce can carry on growing.
Do you think you've been too optimistic about disruption at the Channel? Aren't we completely reliant on France's preparations?
I think it's important that we work with the French and with others in order to ensure that we have the smoothest possible exit from the European Union. In the event of no deal, of course, the EU has its obligations, but we here in the UK are doing everything possible in order to make sure that we are ready, come what may, to leave on October the 31st and to honour the instruction of the British people to leave the European Union.
Are you going to lift the competition law for food industry so they can coordinate food supply in the event of no deal?
Well, I'm confident because the UK has a very resilient food supply system that actually we will be able to make sure that people have a wide range and all the choice that they need. But of course, we're constantly talking to supermarkets, food distributors and others to see what more the government can do to help, and we stand ready to ensure that the regime that we put in place as a government is responsive to their needs.
But isn't this the worst possible time for food supply? I mean, if we no deal in October, because then it makes us even more reliant on EU food imports, and then there's particular shortages of warehouse spaces at that time of year.
Oh, well, leaving on October the 31st without a deal would certainly mean that there was pressure on warehouse space. But it's also the case that at different times of the year there are different trade flows. We're ready to manage those flows. Part of the reason why I'm here in Dover today is to make sure that we can leave on October the 31st, and we can make sure that food gets to consumers in the UK, but also our high-quality food produce manages to reach the many consumers in the EU who enjoy British food.
So that was no-deal Brexit minister. I never thought I'd hear the day where we had a no-deal Brexit minister, but we do. And that's Michael Gove. And he's sounding very upbeat. Is that his job? I suppose it is.
Well, I mean, certainly it's his job to sound upbeat, yes. But I think also he's got reason to. And I think particularly if you look at that last sentence that he said about us exporting to the EU, it's in the interest of both sides, both the EU and Britain, that we manage this smoothly, whether it's on the basis of a deal or whether it's on the basis of no deal. It is crucial that we manage it smoothly because it's in the interests of both sides. I believe it will be, and indeed privately on both sides of the Channel. You know, officials are saying, well, you know, we may not actually notice very much difference. Now, I wouldn't want to be complacent and assume that that's going to happen, but equally, I don't think that no deal is the disaster which Remainers quite often paint.
So they are saying, many people are saying, it'd be interesting to get your take on this, Anne, that many of the tariff arrangements, tariff free trade, will be able to continue after a no-deal Brexit for a period of time.
Yes, there is a provision for that under what is called GATT arrangements. If we're actually negotiating a trade deal with them, then that could indeed be the case. And also, I think what we all tend to forget is that some time ago, Europe did actually offer us a no-tariff trade deal, which, you know, theoretically is still there on the table. So I'm hopeful. I mean, we've had 3 years to prepare for this. Preparations have been going on. I personally wish we'd had a no-deal Brexit minister right from the start, because then I think confidence would be a lot higher in our ability to manage. I think the real problem is not going to be chaos in the ports. Is going to be a crisis of confidence.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that people fear it. I mean, you probably remember immediately after the referendum result, everybody thought it was going to be Armageddon. You know, we were going to see huge drops in employment, and rising taxes and emergency budgets. Those things didn't happen. And I think, again, people are so psyched up about no deal that there will be that sort of lack of confidence at the time. But the more businesses are prepared, the smoother it will be. I do rather share Michael Gove's analysis that it will be all right. There will be glitches, there will be hitches. You know, we're not children. But largely, it will be all right.
Well, I agree with you that the worry about... This is Martin Summers here speaking. I agree with you that... There's been too much talk of things like ports not working, and so I think the real problem is a run on the pound, and then the Chancellor having to raise interest rates, and then you get a Brexit recession. And of course, if you're going to fight a general election on the back of that, you're likely to lose. And it's, that's because most people don't want a no-deal Brexit. And now, I know you do, but most people
don't.
Can
you just explain why a raising interest rates is, might help? Surely that's...
No, you've got to raise... You raise interest rates because you've got to protect your currency. The people, the George Soroses, and John Redwood and others are telling their hedge fund clients that to bet against the pound. And just put a finger on it. It's all a question of confidence, just as it was when you had a sterling crisis in 1967 or whatever. This is the way the world works. You've had a crash in the Turkish lira because they're facing off with the Americans. And then, of course, they have to raise interest rates, and that, of course, then causes a recession. And if the ordinary people who don't really understand the ins and outs of this, if they lose their jobs and their savings, they blame the people that put us in the position, the people who said they wanted a no-deal Brexit.
Jeff, we heard a lot of scare stories, as Anne pointed out, about everything collapsing, the economy being a disaster straight after the referendum. Do you think things might be any different if we actually do leave without a deal on Halloween?
If it's planned for and if action's taken, then a lot of those challenges can be overcome.
Michael Gove is the man. He's planning for everything.
And he has a very good reputation for the departments he's managed and delivering what he's been asked to deliver. So I am less concerned about it than I was, because there is now a clear sign of it being managed. But I would still prefer we had an agreed deal rather than no deal.
There's another aspect to all of this, and that is that the European Union is ploughing along with the EU army, which many people in the British army are not really content about. In fact, they've really now pulled out of any kind of integration with the EU army. And we're going to hear now a short clip from Guy Verhofstadt from the European Union about why he believes an EU army is absolutely necessary and why it's got to happen.
This European defence community, that is, in my opinion, the only way to make better use of the enormous amounts that we put in military, yeah? Because Europeans put more or less 42% of the Americans in military. That's three times more than the Russians. Europeans put three times more money in military than Russia. But I'm not sure that we are capable to do the number of operations of the Russian army. I don't think so. So the reason is a lack, is an enormous, enormous waste of money, because the non-existence of a European defence community, and it's not, in fact, compensated by the inflation of bilateral arrangements we have between countries. You call it an army, you can call it as you wish, but the European defence community should be an enormous saving of money, and at the same time an increase of the security of this continent, who is today incapable, not capable, to take its responsibility in its own neighbourhood.
Martin?
I think this is... there is attempts at European cooperation on a military level, but it has never come to anything. I was an aid worker in Bosnia during the 90s, and the EU really couldn't organise itself to intervene. NATO ultimately intervened against the UN Security Council, and of course, you know, I get fed up with the pro-Remain case being around things like the European army or trouble at the ports. The real problems are economic.
Martin, what Guy Verhofstadt's saying very clearly there is there are enormous economies of scale to be had from having a European economic community and a European Union, and we're just turning our back on all that.
Well, I mean, if we leave, they can go ahead and have their European army, and probably we may end up fighting them somewhere in Yugoslavia or whatever, if that's what people ultimately, we're going to go down that kind of road. People, the debate has been conducted on the wrong level about the wrong things. That's the trouble.
What were the right things?
Well, what you mentioned earlier, that we didn't have a crash at the end of, when we voted in 2016. Well, in actual fact, what happened is the pound lost a fifth of its value, which made us all one-fifth poorer. And, of course, that's why real wages haven't risen in this country. And, of course, the other thing is...
Martin, I'm questioning what you're saying about the fifth of its value, because we haven't gone below the value of the Swiss franc or the euro,
All right. The point is we've lost... Everybody sees the downside risks to the pound. The other thing that happened is Mark Carney dropped in a huge pile of quantitative easing. Now, the banking system, Deutsche Bank, is still insolvent. It was insolvent before before we voted to leave the European Union, it's still insolvent. If Deutsche Bank collapses, the British banking system will collapse the same afternoon, in or out of the EU. This is the sort of thing we should have been talking about for the last 5 years, and instead we've been talking about Brexit.
Surely out of the EU, we're going to be a lot better off than actually in the euro.
No, it won't make the slightest difference because of the big bang in the city, which was pushed by the Conservative Party in the 1980s. And that, of course, opened us up to all of this. And all of this reaction now by little Englanders or little Norwegianers or whoever it is, little Slovenians, the real problem is the international banking system is integrated and it's absolutely insolvent. It's been insolvent since 2008.
What you're talking about is getting rid of exchange controls, is it?
Well, so allowing in 1979,
Martin,
you couldn't...
Stop shouting for
a second. Until 1979, you couldn't take more than £1,000 out of this country without permission from the government. That was sovereignty.
And
it's been a long time ago.
Disagreeing with Martin there. What do you think?
Yes, I mean, I've been disagreeing with a number of things as the discussion has gone along. But, I mean, the fact is that the euro is not stable. We've seen the problems that have occurred over Greece, for example. Germany has done a huge amount of bailing out and is becoming less and less and less able to do that. I'm not sure that the EU is going to be a great focus of economic stability in the future. And, of course, we never look at that. We always say, should we come out, should we go in? And all the dangers that are discussed are about coming out. We never actually discuss the dangers of staying in. And yet Mark Carney himself, who's certainly no Brexiteer, said in evidence to the Select Committee that there were dangers in staying in and dangers in coming out. And, of course, we always overlook the former. But if I could very quickly also return to that discussion on defence. Defence is a matter for NATO. That is what has kept the peace steadily since it was formed in the 1950s. NATO has kept the peace. And... we pay our full dues to NATO. An awful lot of other European countries do not. If they want coordination, perhaps they should start there.
Martin?
About
NATO.
About NATO. Well, I don't think NATO has kept the peace, to be honest with you. NATO's. If we want sovereignty, we need to leave NATO. I'm afraid I'm a leave NATO person. We need to get US bases out of this country. We don't want to be dragged to war with Iraq. We didn't want to be dragged to war with Iraq. We certainly don't want to be dragged to war with Iran, which is another thing we should be talking about instead of Brexit and the banking system as well. The international banking system is absolutely vulnerable to crash.
You've said that,
Martin. Not
Martin,
because of the euro.
Martin, you've said that. Let's let Jeff have his say. What do you make about these things?
Well, the first thing is what I support and wanted to be part of was a trading entity in the form of the EU. It certainly wasn't an army. The thought of 27 countries coming together and working out how their army is going to operate is actually quite frightening and removes any agility and ability to respond to a situation. But actually it highlights the same problem.
You can imagine, can't you, with the EU army, every general in charge or field marshal from every country having a veto on what they're going to do.
Absolutely.
I can't imagine it being all that versatile.
Just think how big all the equipment's going to have the signs in so many languages. I mean, but it's also symptomatic of the problem. The euro is a classic example that you end up with a central currency that doesn't actually have a central fiscal policy and financial governance to go with it. So... actually, this is highlighting all the problems of why the EU is vulnerable. And Anne's comments about the economic viability of the EU on an ongoing basis, there is nothing to suggest stability there. And there is a lot to suggest that our economy potentially could be much more stable. If you actually look at those business leaders who are advocating leave, one actually recognises that they have run successful businesses and they believe they can continue to do so. And as far as the international banking system is concerned, what we have to recognise as well is that international trade, digital communication, financial control has all come on so massively since the time when we could only take 50 quid or 1,000 quid out of the country. It's not possible to bring those controls back again without a draconian centralist government, and I think that would be a very detrimental
step. I think you'd probably have to do it on a Friday, around about the time of this show, on a Friday, otherwise you'd, the money would be flying around, the trillions would be flying around very, very quickly, probably propelled by computer algorithms. So, anyway, yes, I don't think Margaret Thatcher was thinking about that when she decided to get rid of exchange controls originally. Final words on Brexit. You first, Anne. Any other thoughts about, whether we're going to be leaving, how it's all going to work? And I suppose for many of us, it seems like it might be like the millennium bug, you know, where there was this big hoo-ha created, it's going to be really terrible, and then, you know, the next day everyone wakes up and it's just the same as every other day.
Yes, I mean, I think it will be exactly that scenario. It's not going to be a disaster if we go without a deal. My big fear would be that the EU would come to an agreement on the backstop, and we'd be so relieved about that, that we then just go ahead with the May deal, whereas in fact there are other aspects of the May deal. You've been discussing one of them now, which is the European army. There are other aspects of the May deal which are not so good. So I would actually prefer us to have a clean break and then negotiate from that point.
But hang on, Verhofstadt and the rest, Anne, have made it absolutely clear that the backstop is staying. It's not going. They've made that clear.
Yeah. That is their negotiating position at the moment. As I've said, my fear is that they might actually back off that, and that we will be so relieved if that happens that we don't actually give due consideration to some of the other aspects of the May deal. But I, as I say, what I would like to see is I'd like to see a clean break now and then negotiate a trade deal and other things which we need to do with all countries with whom we want to cooperate.
And some are saying also that European Union, the Commission, etc., are very worried that other countries might look at Britain leaving and say, right, well, they've done it, now we're going to.
Well, why do you think they've made it so difficult for us? I mean, that has been, and they've said so, actually, they've said so in terms, or Junckers has, that has been one of their big motivations for being so intransigent, and it's been they don't want to make it easy for members to leave, because if they do, others might follow our example. So I think that's a given. They want to make things difficult for us, but if we go, and if we make a big success of it, as I believe we will, then I think that in itself might persuade some others to do the same.
Backstop, Martin?
The Irish aren't going to give up the backstop. Sinn Féin have already made a position clear. There's going to have to be a vote on the United Ireland. There's probably going to have to be a vote on an independent Scotland if there's a no-deal Brexit. That's what's going to happen, just like Yugoslavia.
So there's going to be a war, is there?
There has been a war, actually, in Northern Ireland. It went on for 30 years, you remember?
Now, we're talking about now.
There's going to have to be a reckoning about sovereignty, because the six counties didn't vote to leave the European Union. And nor did Scotland. And
do you think it's any coincidence that Stormont has been closed for the last couple of years?
No, because it's been closed for other reasons, Tony.
Nothing to do with this, then.
No.
Jeff, what do you make of the backstop, then? Is that going to go? Is it, you know... And any final thoughts on Brexit?
It needs wiser men than me to comment on the backstop and how that's going to operate. I just firmly believe that... We have to remove some of the emotive debate that's going on and actually remember that we have to get a solution for this that works for the best of everybody in this country. And it worries me that emotive words are being used on both sides. Emotive opinions are being expressed as if they are fact by many people when there is not one jot of substance to justify them, and I just wish that we could that everybody could stand back a little and try and work a solution that will carry a majority of support.
I mean, even if it's just this week, it does look like the most likely outcome is going to be we're going to leave with no deal on Halloween. What are your thoughts about my millennium bug? Slightly a flippant question, but is it going to be a disaster the day after, or are we not going to notice it?
I'm not going to answer that question, but I'm going to. My view is that within 5 years, whatever happens, this will appear to be far less significant than it appears to be at the moment. That doesn't mean it couldn't be traumatic over a period of days and weeks, but in the scheme of things and in the scheme of the economy, it will not be as significant as people are fearing.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU settlement scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
So you're listening to the BCFM Politics Show from the People's Republic of Stokescroft studios in Stokescroft in Bristol, not at BCFM, as we had a fire yesterday in our studios. But I hope we're coming through loud and clear on the internet stream for you. And I'm also joined on the line by Anne Widdicombe, who's MEP, South West Brexit Party MEP, Martin Summers, who is a Irish Republican Labour activist, and Jeff Gollop, former Deputy Mayor, and he's now a Conservative councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henlees. Let's go on to talk a bit about the City Council here and how successful or otherwise the Mayor has been, Jeff, because I know you've been quite concerned that there have been ways of working going on in the Mayor's office that really, and not just you that's been criticising them, it's also external auditors of the City that have been looking at these issues too.
Indeed. I mean, you're referring specifically to the issue with the former chief executive. There are recommendations that have gone to council how the dismissal of senior officers should be dealt with in the future. And the wording in the proposals is that if those recommendations are breached, it would be a disciplinary issue for members of staff, and it would be a code of conduct issue for members of council or the mayor. But strangely enough, that doesn't apply to the previous decision, even though the actions that were taken were contrary to best practice and normally accepted ways of dealing with higher paid employees.
So can you explain that? Why is it that that this £98,000 was paid, which didn't have to be paid? I mean, it's really just a gift. It's almost a personal, private gift from the mayor to this individual who was a former chief executive. And that should have, there should have been disciplinary action over that in a future occasion, but not when it actually happened 2 or 3 years ago.
That's the bit I and a number of other members cannot understand. If it was a necessary payment to induce an outcome that the mayor believed was essential, to be honest, he should say so. And there may well be sympathy for that situation.
Has there been any explanation from the mayor as to why this £98,000 of our money was paid?
No explanation at all.
Any gossip or guesswork about why it might have been paid? I mean, this is a lot of money, and it's our taxpayers' money, has been given as a gift by the mayor to an individual.
It is very strange in a discussion in council.
I wish he'd give me a gift of £98,000.
Well, exactly. No one's ever paid me to walk away from a job in that situation. I did suggest he might like to do so, but he's not taking me up on that offer either. It is extraordinary, and it is unfortunately an indictment of the mayoral system that any one person is in the position to instigate such payments.
Martin?
Well, obviously I don't know the detail of this case as closely as Jeff does, because he's a member of the council and so on. I certainly agree that the mayoral system is flawed. I didn't really want to have a mayor in this city. But it was government policy at the time of the Conservative Party, and a small majority of a very small turnout decided we were going to have one, and so we've got one. But it's not necessarily ideal for all the reasons that have been said.
I'm regularly asking Marvin, the mayor, if he'll come on to this programme, but he's said now, just don't bother contacting him because I'm not coming on. But one person that does speak for him, he does speak in the council chamber. We can hear him there. And also, let's have a listen now to a few weeks ago at the full council meeting. And this is the end of the Mayor Marvin Rees's annual address to the city, followed by Marge Hickman, who's the leader of the Labour group on the City Council, although one does wonder what councillors are really supposed to do anymore, since they seem to get overridden constantly by the Mayor. I think it was... Gary Hopkins from the Lib Dem group last week or 2 weeks ago on this programme said he thought what the mayor was trying to do, Jeff, was abolish the council by shutting councillors out of most of the main activities that the council was up to. Having, for example, groups which were appointed by the mayor to various on various issues in the city where councillors were excluded. I mean, I find that quite extraordinary.
I've certainly raised concerns about that. I have to say the answers I've had back from the mayor don't suggest that is the case. I mean, the mayor has set up a one city plan, working with public sector and private sector across the whole of Bristol. He's identified critical areas in the city where the city has failed and is failing to perform, and he's working with the members of the one city plan to deliver key outcomes. And he's set up four different groups, which is bringing experts in different fields to advise. They can't make decisions. They can only advise the mayor of what he can do. So you're putting me in a really embarrassing position because I'm sitting here defending the mayor, which is not something I normally volunteer to
do. But surely councillors should be involved in those groups, shouldn't they?
And I've had discussions with the mayor's office about how we can actually remedy that. Because not only should councillors be involved, but actually councillors can contribute because they have a knowledge of all sorts of aspects of the city which could be helpful.
Also, they're elected. Let's have a listen now to the end of Marvin's annual address and also the speech given by the leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, Marge Hickman, straight afterwards.
If you want to get stuff done, if you're prepared to put aside the ping pong of chamber politics, and you want to come and say what you actually want to get done for Bristol, and you can tell me what you need from me to help you do it, let me know. I'm all ears. We'll work with you, and we have included people in those pieces of work sometimes until things begin to disintegrate. We want to hear from you. But if you want to play headline chasing, bite my ankles, talk the city down, and spend time searching for small problems with big plans, then I'm afraid I have to leave you to it. There's too much going on for us to get tied up in that. But whatever your conclusion on where you want to stand, we're going to continue committed to our promises for Bristol, and we're going to continue delivering for Bristol. Thank you.
Thank you. I would ask Councillor Hickman to respond as leader of the Labour group.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Thank you, Marvin, both for your inspiring speech on the radical actions we're taking to address the climate emergency and for another brilliant annual address. I want to thank you for the national leadership which you've shown on issues facing Bristol and beyond. Particularly just 2 weeks ago, getting almost 450 local councils from across the UK to follow our lead, declare a climate emergency and commit to aligning with sustainable development goals. Proof once again that Labour in local government are delivering, particularly in Bristol. But I also want to say something about the national backdrop we face, continued Tory austerity and Boris facing off against Jeremy. Now, a few Tories have spoken about their concerns around blue-on-blue attacks, but here in Bristol, this isn't a concern. And I'm not just talking about Richard's letters to the Post about the Prime Minister, though the Tory party office must spend most of its budget on stamps. This is about a local Tory advert which saw them make a series of claims about our council. They were wrong on Bristol libraries. Labour is the only party to have voted to fund them. And they were wrong on Bristol's recycling rate. We're the best core city in the country at recycling, and Labour is delivering the Hartcliffe Centre, which other mayors and parties have left behind. But to give them some credit, one out of six claims by the Tories was actually accurate. It reads, shock report, bungling council mismanagement leads to a £29 million cock-up. And this is the advertisement that was in the paper just before the local elections this year. Even with Craig not being here today, I can still feel his ears pricking up. But before anyone texts him about my meltdown in this continuing heatwave, I should say that the Tories did helpfully reference this claim from the Bristol Post. It was in February 2017. Hang on, I think that the Tories may have missed something. The shock report into the 29 million cock-up covers the period before Labour took control. This shock report was, you might remember, authored by the former head of Audit Commission. He detailed a rudderless council on the edge, going bust, facing the same fate as Northamptonshire, who this year could not even afford to hold their elections. And who was in charge during this mismanagement, this cock-up described by Bristol Tory Association? Only Tory councillor Jeff Gollop, George Ferguson's cabinet member for finance. Blue on blue indeed. Now, I could talk for days about what our Labour administration have got done for Bristol, but with an already lengthy meeting and with even the official opposition campaigning to show just how much Labour have turned round the council, I'm not sure that there's anything more to add. Marvin, comrades, let's keep delivering for Bristol.
Okay, so that's Marge Hickman there speaking a few weeks ago, and actually going straight for your jugular, at least attempting to, Jeff.
Yeah, do you know, it's extraordinary. The comments like that have been coming from the Labour Party ever since Marvin came to power. I have offered to meet with them, to talk with them, and to talk with senior officers about the issues that arose at that time. The only person who's spoken to me is Stephen Bundred. They are interested in the stories that they can put out. They're not interested in the facts.
And you know what strikes me is actually she is doing exactly what Marvin is accusing everyone else of doing.
And this is the classic situation. Marvin takes the view, and she does, that any criticism of the blessed Marvin's administration is being political. What they can't understand is that many of us as councillors actually care profoundly about the way our city operates, the way it's governed, the way decisions are taken.
But you're having pot shots against Marvin. Carry on.
Yeah, and we expect to be critical when we think something is not working right, such as the former chief executive, but to be supportive when things are either working well or being trialled. What we can't do is be negative all the time, and that is not right. But he cannot turn round and blame us for nipping him at the ankles when £98,000 is misspent, when decisions are made about the developments on Temple Island, a whole host of things. I could go on with the list. He's got to be prepared to robustly defend those, not see that as something negative, because we're actually there to represent our residents. And our postbag is such, we're getting complaints from residents about a whole host of this administration's
policies. But Marvin, I mean, you're accusing Marvin of being the problem when it comes to the libraries. Actually, surely he saved the libraries.
Marvin didn't save the libraries. I mean, he put forward a proposal to close three quarters of our libraries. It was only after a result of a massive community campaign across the city that actually the message was put across, and they changed their views. So very strange to... I mean, they voted to save the libraries in the end in a budget that they were forced to put together because they had been defeated time and time again by residents saying how much they valued their libraries.
Martin Summers, it doesn't look as if there is the kind of proper cut and thrust and debate and acceptability of criticism that's necessary for democracy to work in the city at the moment, does it?
Well, I think all of these technical questions about whether money was misspent and so on, I think that's absolutely fair comment by all concerned. I think the backlog to all of this is the massive cuts to the central government grants to local authorities since austerity, which we should never have pursued. There's no reason at all to cut public expenditure, as we're now finding out with the Boris Johnson
surely,
running around with a magic money tree shaking it all over
surely,
the place.
Surely, Marvin, that the mayor should be robustly defending what he's doing. I'm actually saying exactly what you've just said.
I'm trying to distinguish between Marvin as an individual potentially making mistakes about things that he's done, which I think is absolutely fair criticism if people think that that's the case, and the overall pattern of the situation, which is that nobody with any sense realises, argues with the fact that local government has massive cuts to its budget. And that was totally unnecessary. As we now discover, with a no-deal Brexit on the horizon, any amount of money can be found. We've got tax cuts for the wealthy, and we've got extra money for 20,000 police officers to replace the 20,000 that have been sacked. It's all actually political games at national level.
Okay.
At local level, we try to make sense of what the national mess has pushed in our direction.
Anne, could you comment on what you make of the enormous cuts there have been to local government? Because, I mean, that's one of the reasons, surely, that the mayor here is having to cut left, right and centre, is because he's being left with virtually no money coming from central government.
Well, of course, I mean, there has been austerity, which has gradually been relieved. But there was certainly, and some local councils managed much better than others. And a lot of that is down to determination and priorities and how much you're prepared to juggle resources.
Well, also, and how wealthy they are. I mean, some councils are wealthier than others, aren't they? Wealthy people.
Yeah, but some councils have also husbanded their resources and their finances a lot better than others. Now, what I cannot do here is comment on the detail of this particular argument that's going on in Bristol, because I'm not familiar with the detailed workings of the council or indeed of the mayor's office. What I would quite like to do is just to make a general comment on mayors. I welcomed elected mayors when they were proposed, because I had been so impressed, and I saw it at first hand, by what Giuliani had been doing in New York. And I thought, if you can put more power into the hands of elected mayors, they will have to deliver what the people want. I've been a bit disillusioned with that, because in practice that hasn't worked out. In practice, actually, the powers aren't as great as they might be. But the accountability sometimes isn't as great as it might be either, which I think is part of the issue here.
Accountability brings us perfectly on to our next item, which is an interview I did earlier this week with freelance journalist Joanna Booth. She lives down in Hotwells, and she's extremely concerned about developments which are taking place, at least supposed to be taking place, something called, the name of her part of the city is being changed to Western Harbour. Before we hear from Joanna, though, Jeff, maybe you can fill us in. What stage is this development at? Because we've seen pictures in the local newspapers of high-rise blocks going up around that part of the city, and yet local people are being kept in the dark about what's happening.
Well, this is a classic example of mayoral responsibility, if you like. The mayor has announced that a very large development is going into that area with many thousands of new units, with a change to the road system. And there is meant to be a consultation about to happen. And I think it's just been launched. But I don't know how a decision like that can be brought forward almost now. Is a de facto going to happen, because there's a choice of three options, when, to be honest, residents across the city haven't been given a chance to be consulted.
This does often happen with consultations, doesn't it? You get given several options, and actually you feel like saying, well, actually none of the above are going to work at all. So maybe the whole consultation process is a little bit of a PR thing. But anyway, let's hear now from Joanna. And I spoke to her earlier this week about this proposed Western Harbour development. So how accountable do you think Marvin has been compared to George Ferguson and previous administration?
Well, I don't think that we even know. I don't know who he's accountable to. For example, we live on the... I'm also part of the Cumberland Basin Stakeholder Group, and the current administration...
Is that around Hotwells area?
That's around Hotwells, yes. Yeah. So we're about to have a consultation come up at the end of August and September about huge redevelopments of the Western Harbour. Now, we didn't even know that the Cumberland Basin's name had changed to the Western Harbour until the Bristol investment brochure was leaked on one of Marvin's trips to, I think it was Malaysia. And then we found out about how it was being promoted as having 3,500 homes, that it was worth investment of over £1 billion, and that it was all going to be redeveloped. Now, the council, this was in 2017, in September, in January 2018, the report was commissioned with Arup for £50,000 on 12 on options of how the area would look. To consult, there was going to be three options going out to consultation the years ahead. So this is 18 months ago now. In February 2018, the local plan went out for consultation, for comments, and we finally got to see which area specifically and what they were going to do to it was involved in the Western Harbour. In March 2019, another local plan consultation went out and the area had increased. Now, the Western Harbour not only was north of the floating harbour, it was including Cumberland Basin South, below it, south. And at that point, the housing was reduced down to 2,500 plus 500 homes for, or for homes to fit 500 students. And the options still weren't available. So we didn't know what was going to happen there, even while the consultation was closing in April 2019 about what residents could do or what residents could say, for example. So those options were leaked, not leaked. They were shown to the BBC on the weekend, I guess. So on Monday, they were reported by BBC Radio Bristol, and we finally got to hear about three options, the Eastern option, Western option, Hybrid option. And before that, some residents had been trying to find out. The first thing that was reported about what was going to happen was an interview with Kevin Slocum, Colin Moulton, and I believe Marvin Rees that was in Bristol 24/7. That was this year, January 2019, after the trips, you know, to Malaysia investment brochure. At that point, we found out a little more about it and how they were going to take down the system around the Cumberland Basin, the traffic, the road system. So up till now, we still haven't seen the report by Arup. Our councillor hadn't heard anything about it until January 2019 when Bristol 24/7 wrote about it. And we don't know what the other options are, apart from these three that are going out to consultation and were told to the BBC.
But I mean, isn't this just the way that things work nowadays? That if you want to get lots of development done, houses built, the best thing is just to talk straight to the developers and actually... Sometimes the local councillors can just be getting in the way.
They seem to be getting in the way. I mean, Mark Wright, the Hot Wells and Harbourside councillor, said that he finds it utterly remarkable that they're acting like this, that the report has not been released. He said in 12 years of being a councillor, he has not seen administration hide. I mean, he finally got a chance to see it about a month ago. Not the report. He couldn't take it away. He was shown into a room where there was a presentation on the wall or on some kind of screen or monitor, and he could take notes. And that was really the first time we saw detail.
But, I mean, surely this is how these developments are done nowadays. It's just the way it's done nowadays. And the council is, and Marvin Rees particularly, is saying, well, look, I'm doing these deals directly with the developers. And isn't that why we elected a mayor, to get these deals done?
I think there still needs to be scrutiny and accountability. I mean... I don't understand how people's lives can be affected to such an extent without some kind of scrutiny. There are homes that are going to be demolished in this the newly named Western Harbour, but we don't know which ones. We don't know what's going to happen at all. And no one is releasing information. Is that how things happen these days? I mean, I find it astounding, personally.
So that's Joe in a booth there, speaking to me earlier this week. Jeff, this is massively affects people right on their doorsteps. Some houses being demolished, and yet people aren't really being informed as to what the proposals are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is where there is too much power. Too much power. And as was said there, not enough scrutiny. There is no ability to check and the balance of what is happening. And we will be presented, I suspect, with a final deal.
I mean, over the years, we've come to expect there's some sort of balance between the needs and the interests of local people and the needs and the interests of the developers and their shareholders wanting to make money out of building things. It does seem as if maybe the balance has swung to... It's a field day for developers now.
It appears that way. And, you know, I was slightly surprised to hear you almost sticking up for the developers in your interview, because actually the role of council and councillors is to look after your existing residents as well as be catering for and planning for future residents. And at the moment, the balance has gone too far the wrong way. And it's not acceptable. You know, perhaps you should invite Mark Wright to come along and talk about it in more detail, because he knows the situation, but he's a good ward councillor. He would be there trying to represent and communicate with his residents. And he doesn't know what to tell them because he's not been informed. That is not acceptable.
Martin Summers, we've had this Western Harbour development on the cards now for the last 18 months, 2 years or so, and people still are not aware whether their bulldozers are going to come and demolish their houses or not.
Well, I think the points have been made that the balance of power between developers and local authorities has always been too far in favour of the developers. And, of course, the whole thing of having elected mayors was that they were going to get things done, like the arena, for example, which had been hanging around for years. And the idea of having elected mayors, and, of course, George Ferguson bought into this, and Marvin Rees has also bought into the same thing. And, of course, the powers of mayors are enormous. They can ignore local councillors, they can ignore local people, they can set up a completely separate structure answerable only to them. That was designed in the design of elected mayors. Ken Livingstone in London has always been opposed to elected mayors. He did most of the good work he did in the 1980s. He did as the leader of the Labour group, leading the council as council leader and answerable to his group. The whole thing of having mayors, as Anne said, it comes from America. It was a back-of-the-envelope idea jotted down by David Cameron. And, of course, we also copied this stupid idea of electing police chiefs, apart from in Northern Ireland, where it turned into a bloodbath. And we copy lots of stupid things from America, including elected mayors. And that's why we're in a mess.
Can I just make one point that is really fundamental to this? If the council is procuring a service or procuring house building, it has to go through all the proper tendering processes. If it appoints a developer, it doesn't. And that's an issue that perhaps you might like to develop in the weeks and months ahead.
Yes, that's an interesting point.
Because it removes all the controls and the balances.
Yeah, well, ultimately, we're running to a situation where local authorities don't do anything much. That's where we're going, and we've been going there since the 1980s.
Anne, what do you think of that?
First of all, again, I've hardly heard what the others have said. And again, I don't know the detail of this particular local issue. And without knowing the detail of it, I don't particularly want to pontificate away. But what I would say is that a good mayor, a mayor even having powers, will at least explain and consult about what he's doing. And so I think it's rather a pity if local councillors think they've been ignored completely. But what I don't know is whether they have had the opportunity to make all those representations, but have merely found that they're rejected.
Yes, it may be also that the developers are really happy to have a cooperative mayor because the local council is able to give them planning permission. The council, if it becomes a council policy, is much more likely to give planning permission, which can turn a field or a park, which is worth virtually nothing to a developer, into something which is worth millions and millions of pounds an acre just by giving them planning permission. But anyway, it would also be interesting to, I think, look at the smacking ban this week. In Scotland, parents who act in the heat of the moment are unlikely to be prosecuted, but any smacking of children could be a criminal offence, and that process is now started in Scotland. That will become law. In Wales, they're also looking at this too. For a long time, smacking was not an offence unless it caused any kind of like permanent bruising or anything like that. So this law is slowly changing. Let's start with you, Martin, what you make of this. Any kind of chastising physically of children could be a criminal offence very soon in Scotland and in Wales.
Well, in 1986, the use of corporal punishment was banned in schools, state schools in this country. It was banned in Poland in 1793. We've been very backward on this over many, many years.
Okay, so you're behind this, Jeff.
I think parents have got to have the ability to discipline their children. And I think there should be a lot of pressure not to smack, but I don't believe they should be banned from doing so.
Why not?
Because at the end of the day, each parent has to determine how they deal with their own individual offspring.
And what do you make of this smacking ban?
I think this is a complete load of nonsense. We expect parents to be responsible for their children. They've got to decide on the discipline, and providing they aren't seriously hurting their children, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to be in favour of that. A light smack on the legs or on the bottom does no harm at all, and most parents think that.
What about you? Are you a parent yourself, and have you actually had any experience of this?
I'm not a parent myself. I have occasionally tapped a visiting child member of the family, certainly not somebody outside the family, but that is with parental approval, and it is a tap. And sometimes it's a warning tap if they're hurting another child, for example. There is nothing wrong with that.
OK, Anne Widdecombe, Brexit Party MEP for the South West of England. Jeff Gollop, former Deputy Mayor, now Chair of Scrutiny here at Bristol City Council for the Conservative Party. Martin, thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back after some music with our International Hour.
Most of us just sell out right away.
It's very cleansing for the soul to have no passion at all.